Accession number 28416, Reel 7.
Bill, you were just telling me about Brigadier Anderson making the trapdoor. You now had your own personal, or with your friends, you had your own personal private workshop up there on the top floor.
Yes.
Can you take me on from there?
I'll try. Wonderful moments. One thing must be recorded first, that in order to get all this, of course, the team had grown from Jack Best and I and Tony Rolt and David Walker, from a humble four to what's reckoned to be, oh, I don't know, 52 was really the actual strength of the people of the British quarters who were actually helping this along. To picture it easier, probably to say that perhaps 40 of them were stooges doing a period of time each during the day of all the watching the Germans arrive and leave and where they go and the warning through to us with our warning system. With that set up and working, we're okay up there. We can't be caught making a noise or being seen doing anything we didn't ought to be doing. So we've got a factory and we've got some policemen outside it of our own, and off we go. Well, we're now talking about, I should think, 1944, somewhere about September, October. Yes, the war is going very well. The invasion's taken place. The radio is the wonderful thing that we have, which we didn't have before. The Frenchman, I think, gave us a radio when they left the camp. And dear old Dick Howe and all his gang had built a little alcove somewhere up in that roof, somewhere near where we were with our big factory, but it was equally in the roof and the eaves, I think, but I never saw it. I don't think Jack did either. And up every evening we'd go up there, two or perhaps three people. It had to be, of course, where the electricity was, which is also go up there and they listened to the BBC. There must have been special broadcasts, or perhaps the range gets there anyway. I don't know enough about it. But every evening the news is read, jotted down like you're jotting this down now, and the dear horse, now what's his name? Everybody knows he's called the Horse. I can't go back over his real name, but he would then bring this round all the British sector, saying, "This is the news for today." And that is a wonderful thing to spur you on, especially when things are going well. Because, after all these guys there had been at the failure of the protection of France, and now they were hearing about the relief of France. And that did them good. Wonderful. However, that was over there, and we were on our patch, and we've still got to build this glider.
Can I just interrupt for 1 second? You said the French left. The entire French contingent moved?
I don't think they all went, but they were certainly replaced by others.
Right.
Because at the very end, and this is after Christmas of 44 now, I think, in the last 2 months of the war, perhaps, even, the French came in and they were brought in because the Germans always retracted prisoners from the front if they're losing the front. And the French, and they came into the castle. So, but they were just the friendly ones who the British had been living with for a year or more, or 2 years, year and a half. Sorry, I lost it.
And well, you were going to return to the glider making. You were going to.
Oh yes. We had all we needed. We had this lovely workshop with the lights and the warning. And somebody had to do some work on the fact how are we going to launch this thing, which has got quite heavy now. It's a two-seater. It's going to weigh about 500-600 pounds, probably, two up. And the launching scheme was given a bit of thought by Dick Lorraine. Now, Dick Lorraine was in the senior officers because he was a major of the sappers, again, from the 51st Highland Division. And he joined us quite a lot with Lucy Lockett for making bits, because Lucy Lockett was the one who came from Spangenberg, I think, from out of the Blenheim, like the wing commander. And he had been at Cranwell, of course, RAF training centre. And they really taught you how to build, or at least to see how to build aeroplanes at Cranwell, what with Holton as well. And he had a great knowledge on cables, which was important, because we're going to want control cables, and we could want wiring and all that sort of thing, but wire bracing. And he was very good at metal making too, metal pieces, because wherever you have to join a big bit of wood to another bit, like a wing strut to a wing and a fuselage, you've got to have strong hands reaching out, as it were, lumps of metal reaching out with a hole in, which you can put a bolt through another hole in the other bit of thing. And you've got many joints to make, if you think, the top of the wing, the bottom of the wing, the outside, the halfway along the wing, tail plane, rudder, all these things got to be made. And those two, at the where the Saal House, were surrounded with metal, because they had lovely cupboards to put their clothes in, and they had metal hinges and metal locks and all sorts of bits which we needed. And so they would come looking for a bit which would suit the situation on the wood, and the fastenings for putting them on the wood. And they were a terrific help. The funniest thing I can remember seeing in there, which seems funny to me, was a Scotchman, Peter Allen it must have been, sitting on a, not a chair, because we didn't have chairs, we had something to sit on, a plank, while we're doing the woodwork on building the fuselage. And what's he doing? How did he do it? He's splicing cables. Yeah, he's sitting there with his tartan. He had a what's the tartan thing called you wear, like a skirt?
Kilt.
He had his kilt with him. They didn't all have kilts. I think he was the only one who had a kilt in the camp. But he must have been a Highlander, because he had a kilt. And he was sitting there making cable. I'm sure he was. He died all about a year ago. Because cables, these are for the controls. We've got to get from the stick to the rudder to the tailplane out to the ailerons. And the cabling was, I think, wiring which had been torn down, electric wiring, from in the Saal House again, source of everything. And he was sitting there doing this, and it's a lovely picture. Perhaps John Wotton even came up and painted him there. And I can see it. Yeah. Well, I'm blowed. I can picture that. I can see soaring, jet soaring and planing and soaring, notching. I don't know why, but the floorboards that we got for the spar were pretty thick. I guess they were over an inch thick. That's thick for an ordinary floorboard. And we reckon we had to be too heavy. And I think probably we did the wrong thing, really. So Jack said, all right, he'll thin them down to 3/4. They're going to be used as planks, actually, not as spars that you have nowadays with a lump at the top, a lump at the bottom, and ply joining them, which is light and strong, just as strong. But he had to saw across them, then chisel them off, saw across them, chisel them off. And you can see him beavering away day after day after day, getting these planks ready to be spars, and able to thread through the rib holes. Wonderful. But he did. And then on the end of the, went the metal fittings made by the other guys. And quite unbelievably, it grew. We only know it, what hard work it was when we watched the people at Lasham building the comic one that they built and flew in the year 2000. They worked like dinghy to do it too. Other things in there was the chap, you can see the chap up a ladder on the sloping side of the roof with the tiles all hooked over their bits, and looking out through there across to where the signals are coming in on clear or not clear. There'd only be no more than four people in there anyway at a time, and that came on. We kept on going until it was covered. We did the covering up there, incredibly.
What was covering made of?
Yes, I'm trying to pick just
did
doing that up there.
Did you use sheets or something like that?
Pardon?
Did you use sheets stretched?
Yes,
now
the covering. Ah, thank you. Well, the covering was, yes, bed sheets. They're not sheets exactly. They're things you get in. Bed, not bed bugs. They get in, but bed. You get inside it. We have nowadays, don't we?
Sort of sleeping bags.
Like a sleeping bag.
Yes. Okay.
I don't remember. I'm sure we got in them, yes. You never had to tuck your sheets in at the side, did you? Don't know, can't remember. Sleeping bags, which if you slip them down the edge, you get a nice big piece of material. Yeah. It took a lot of them.
How near to completion did this glider get before you were...
Well, we did have time to get all the fabric on the hull, and the wings, and the tailplane, and the rudder. And we had time to... when the time came that we took it off, to put the wings on. That came quite suddenly, really, because we got from 1945 through to March, to April. April, things started happening. We were still going up there every day, finishing this off, I think. Well, in fact, I'm sure we were, because we were up there when the actual Americans appeared in view, which is rather a wonderful state to happen. Yes, we were up there. It was the 293rd Infantry Division of the American Army.
273rd,
I think, division, who had made their way well ahead of the general advance, because there was an agreed line between the Russians and the Allies, wasn't there, as to where they would stop. And I think this is, Kolditz was in the Russian side, actually. Well, I'm sure it was in the Russian side. And they'd come on far enough that they were going to keep coming on. They didn't come on because of Kolditz. They didn't know about Kolditz. Surprisingly, we think afterwards, but why should they? Germany was full of camps, as you mentioned earlier. Why would they know about Kolditz? And it was the next place that they met some Germans holding them up. They said they travelled across Germany. This is a friend who was in that infantry division at the attack on Kolditz, and he came over to England a couple of times. And he said they came up mostly by open transport or walked, and they walked a hell of a lot of way. They must have had some tanks a front to them, because I think four appeared. Was the first thing that the camp, that the coldest people saw was four tanks on a morning, a dawn morning, way over the hills, about 3 miles away, I suppose. And that was the first indication that somebody had arrived. You were quite a good warning of things coming, because they were held up at Leipzig, which isn't an awful long way away, and the Germans going firing out with 88s and the Americans firing in with something a bit bigger, I hope. There's plenty of noise, but otherwise you vaguely heard bombing going on too. For instance, Dresden actually took place while we were hoping that things were all right, and we didn't even hear about it. It wasn't even mentioned for noise or anything else. And the German headquarters were in Dresden, and at this stage Colditz was very likely to have been turned out of the castle just before the tanks appeared, I mean. But the resistance of the senior British officer, Colonel Todd, to the order of the camp commander over Colonel whatnot, from his headquarters in Berlin, were bring the prisoners out, retreat. And he said, we're not coming out. And he stuck to it. And the German officer, the commandant, got on to the headquarters at Dresden. Dresden was Dresden, wasn't it? Yep. And said, they're not moving. And he said, will you take responsibility for it? And Jeff said, no, I won't take responsibility if anybody's killed. And he banged the telephone down, and that was the end of that conversation. So by standing still, Colonel Todd kept us there, which was great. And that was the time during which a bunch of folks called the Prominenti had been evacuated from Colditz. They were the last ones to, you might say, escape, actually, because they were taken out by the Germans as Prominenti for the benefit of the Germans.
Who were the Prominenti?
Well, they were anybody... Well, the two ones it's easy to remember who they were two of them were relations of the Queen Mother, actually, our Queen Mother, who's gone now, of course. And she was Queen Mother then, of course, yes.
Well, she was no, Queen, right?
She was.
Yes.
Yes, of course she was.
She was Queen.
Their names, I can't bring their names out. And the other one was Haig. General Haig of the First World War, Field Marshal Haig, his son was in there, and he was one of them.
He was one of the Prominenti?
He was one of the Prominenti. He was very poorly, actually. And there was dear old Churchill's relation, the writer. He was a journalist in Norway, taken at Norway when Norway was captured. Nice guy, but he committed suicide in the end. He didn't like the way the world was going. And Michael Alexander. Yeah, he we know. Because he was in our mess, actually, Michael Alexander, at one time. And he died about a month or two ago.
And who was Michael Alexander?
Oh, Michael Alexander, he's like... The Germans... did we talk about this, perhaps? Never mind. Well, Michael Alexander, he was a Prominenti, joined the others. He had been in the Special Air Service when it was created on the North African Front by Stirling, Colonel Stirling. Now, he was on a job in a boat. They were part of the boat squadron at that time. From Alex up the coast a bit, make a raid behind the German lines, blow something up and come home. Well, they blew something up and didn't come home. There were three of them, I think, a corporal and Mike, perhaps just the two of them. And they were caught in, they'd blown something up where there was a transport up, actually. and I think it killed one of the drivers, perhaps. And so the people who caught him when he was trying to get back in daylight, they were going to walk back, and they got picked up just as they left that camp. And because Mike Alexander was wearing a German uniform, not a uniform exactly, but a hat or a jacket or something, he was going to be shot straight away, as they did naturally, until word got to Rommel that Meyer, the corporal, who said, "I'll pass the word that you're General Alexander's nephew or brother-in-law," and he did, and it worked. And Rommel was such a sort of person that he said, "Oh, well, Alexander alive is worth a couple of battalions to us." So they let him come to Germany, where he was locked up for a year and a half, I think. But all he did was read books. And then he got sent to Kollitz. So he was one of those on board. And he made it, of course, when they all got away. I won't talk about how they got away from being prominent, because that's quite a separate story, isn't it?
I only
know it by what I've read.
Yes.
But they were sent out perhaps 2 days before we actually were relieved. They had just time enough to get down to the bottom end of Germany. But they all survived brilliantly. And the battle went on for Kollitz. They lost, I think, 20 infantrymen taking the place, because this was the first time that the SS had been on this part of the front. The ordinary local camp commandant would have given up, of course. Well, he had given up. He said to his base, "We're sticking." But the Americans dealt with everything like they dealt with anything else. They got at them and cleared them out. And the tanks then started rolling a bit nearer, within firing range of the castle, which they could see. And I think there was still some aiming going back from the Germans at this point, because they took a shot at... They fired one shot which hits the castle, actually. And of course, it had to be Barger's room. and then there was a flag flying out of the window, which somebody put out, and it stopped. But it hadn't... The gunnery officer, who's been asked about it, was aiming on, and they were firing, and so that was rather good that somebody did put a flag out.
What flag was put out?
A cross flag of French and British. A pair of them, like that. I didn't see it, it was on the outside.
And you had those flags ready, I suppose. You'd made them, had you? Or?
I don't know. Somebody had them, yes. Yes. It's a good thought. I hadn't thought about how we got them, but we hadn't marched in there with them or anything. Yes. Might have been a white flag too, I don't know. That would be easy to do, except the blankets were blue, of course.
Yes.
However, and I can't guess how long it was after that big bang. It must have been the same day that through that gate, because the arrangement, by the way, that the Colonel Todd had made with the German commandant was that, well, look, you leave your chaps in position until the SS have gone, otherwise they'll be in here, which he did. And but we had chaps who were there going to take their post. Yeah, but it wasn't necessary.
You had people ready to take the place of your local guards. Is that what you're saying?
I've almost lost track of that. Perhaps I'd better stop. I'm not sure. It's rather important. We got to the moment when the American tanks were fired, one shell which landed in Barger's room, and the fact that the colonel our Colonel Todd had arranged with the Colonel Commandant that their troops would remain in place all the time that the SS were there.
The SS were in the town below, were they?
They had been all the time, yes, and then, but they were making their way out now. What this arrangement was, the earlier arrangement that the Colonel had made with our own troops, was that if the SS try and get in the castle, we will fight them out. And at that later point, of course, the Germans would have joined us if they were still there. Yeah, when the SS attacked, but they didn't. They moved off from the area. And that's when the Americans started walking through the town, up the hill, into the castle. And they didn't know what they were going to find, of course, this chap who led the way, who was a good old, what do they call their troops?
GIs.
They didn't call them privates, do they? Or corporals, or... Call them, sorry, you said...
Well, they call them GIs, don't
GIs,
they?
Yes, GI. It was just a GI with a great big... Schmeitzer's type thing on his shoulder, and he looked to who opened the door and got a welcome, because everybody was in the yard then. Yeah, two of them came up, I think, and the colonel in the commandant, who was just outside, was drawn up with his troops to surrender to the Americans. Pupke, who was one of the American officers who came into the camp to take the appels and generally looking after things. Now, what is it somebody says? Oh, who on earth was that? I'm thinking, not saying. Golly. Not Dick. Sorry, no, it's a rather good tale, I thought, but no. It was somebody from the camp who met Pupke at gate and took his pistol off him, didn't take it off him, asked him for it, may I have your pistol, please? And so they swapped, and then he went down into the town with his pistol. It was Purdon, I think, Corin Purdon. I wonder if it was him. Because I said our colonel had arranged a strong force to repel the SS if they try and attack it. Well, they went down to the town to join the Americans in the fighting. Whoever this is who got Pupke's pistol to do it with, I can't get his name out, but if anybody ever read that, they would say, well, it was me, it was him, I mean.
But don't worry.
No, it's an important one, really. Kenneth Lockwood would know. I think four of them went to the town with the Americans, with the two who'd come up, you might say, and were introduced, and explained what the place was and who was there. Which is fair enough. So who was it? Come on, Jack, tell me. Jack! Who was it?
So the Americans liberate the
Mike
camp.
Alexander.
Mark Alexander?
Mike Alexander. It might have been him. Well, it doesn't sound like him.
Well, it's most unlikely, because he's a member of the Prominente and he's been removed.
Thank you. Thank you. I missed that. Yeah, he was the sort of person like him who had done it.
Let's not worry too much about this chap's name.
But anyway, it's an important chap that made this run last, because Pupke was quite amused by it, really, because he always had a German saying when he took them anywhere, if you run for it, I've got to shoot you. And if you put that into German, that was what he was known as. And that's how they swapped the gun over, just for fun. For pleasure, if you like, really. Yes, so we're freed.
The camp is liberated.
Camp separated, yes.
and what happens?
I can't picture any of the French or the Dutch or the whatever anybody did. But we were all waiting to be taken out. Now, this is quite an advanced bit of front. And as we said earlier, we think the Russians were on their way to this bit as fast as they could go and wanted to get it. It was only about 2 days, the second day, you might say, after they had opened the gate, I think they had raised enough transport, which was three great big lorries of theirs, all with coloured drivers, who really drove marvellously, and we all piled aboard to be taken somewhere, Leipzig, actually. And there were still Germans dotted about in the... It's still quite forest country in the woods there. And at one stage, all these drivers were absolutely marvellous. There was a blockage across the road, just some tree trunks and things, and they stopped.